we dig into things like how much new single family is being built in that market, how much new multifamily is being built in that market. Those drive self-storage. Those homes, 12% of the U.S. population uses self-storage.
This is the naked truth about real estate investing. Your host, Javier, has already been through all the brain damage of this business, so you don't have to go through it. That way, you're not exposed to all of the risk of losing your shirt or getting caught with your pants down. So let's dive into another No BS episode right now.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the show, To the Naked Truth About Real Estate Investing. And today I have Drew Dolan all the way from Albuquerque, New Mexico, but he works virtually, right? Just like 2020, everybody now works virtually. He has been in real estate a very long time and has done a whole bunch of asset classes, senior living. He's done some office, he's done multifamily, but now he's focusing on self storage and he's going to let us know why. He has a couple of funds he's going to talk about. And, you know, we'll just have a chat, you know, just in general self storage, which one he likes the most, which one he likes the least. Let's have Drew introduce himself. Drew, welcome to the show.
Killer. Thanks, Javier. Happy to be here. Yeah, DXD is a data-driven self-storage investor, and our core focus is using data and analytics and tech at a very high level to make investment decisions. And the reason that thesis and data match up really well with storage is because storage is an absolute commodity of an asset class. When somebody's going to use storage, going to rent storage, you know, the night before they want to rent it, they want to know, how far is it from my home? Because I don't want to drive very far. Is the unit size I need, like a 10 by 10, available? And what does that cost? And once they get through that decision matrix, they don't care whether it says public storage, extra space, or some other name. And so because we know and have a lot of the data around existing self-storage and what drives new storage, what we really do is we use a predictive analytical model to really determine, here's where we should be building. Here's a property that is underperforming. Let's go buy it and rehab it and then increase the lease rates and turn it into something it's not. So DXD is about 2 years old, 25 total people. As I was telling Javier, you know, we got an office in Albuquerque, but an office in Denver, and then we're spread out, which just allow us to hire the best people. They can work wherever they want. And we've got projects in 8 states from New York to Hawaii.
Cool. 8 states. Awesome. So let me start here by talking about your experience, right? You say you spent, you know, a good portion of your career doing some other asset classes. So why don't you talk to us about those asset classes, and then I have a follow-up question after that.
Sure. Yeah, I got my start in office and did, you know, a tiny bit of single family residential, mostly lot development until the GFC, when really office got crushed, single family got crushed. We jumped into multifamily, built 200, 300 unit garden style complexes, then jumped into senior living, touched industrial, touched hospitality, you know, really diverse background. And I've been in storage for about 5 years. The last asset that I was mostly involved with was senior living. Senior living is the complete opposite of self-storage. Senior living is a operating company. And you got 50 employees, you got nurses, you got doctors, you're taking care of very vulnerable people. You got personal protective gear for COVID. I mean, COVID just crushed senior living. It'll come back, but it got crushed. Versus self-storage, we have 1.5, 2 employees. We don't have to worry about tenant improvements. When somebody leaves, we sweep something out. You know, when you think about what happened in inflation, yeah, we had rents go up on a lot of different asset types, like multifamily and self-storage. But something like senior living got like a double whammy. Not only did, well, nobody moved in for 2 years almost, but costs of operating went way up. More masks, more sanitizer, you know, more people versus self-storage. You know, our operating costs the last 2 years of inflation have remained relatively flat. I mean, yes, it's gone up, but relatively flat. But what rents have done in self-storage is essentially across the country gone up 30 to 50% in the last 2 years. And fundamentally, the reason why storage has done so well, and it does really well during recessions, because it thrives on disruption, divorce, job losses, people moving in together, moving cities for jobs. But there are really three core reasons storage did really well during this, you know, last pandemic. One, work from home. People moved out bedroom furniture for a home office, a home gym. They finally remodeled, you know, that whole disruption. And we're never going back. It's never going to go back the way it was pre-COVID, where you, some people will have to show up every day, but a lot of us, our lives are changed forever. On top of that, the second reason why storage did so well is just the extreme increase in multifamily rents and the run-up in single-family home prices and the recent run-up in mortgage rates. Incomes did not keep pace with the cost of housing. So if somebody only has $1,300 to spend on an apartment, maybe before they could afford a three-bedroom. Now they can only afford a two-bedroom, but they have stuff for a three-bedroom they don't want to sell or give away. So they use storage, and storage becomes more and more a part of their lifestyle. And the last reason, which is really interesting, is 50% of the people that rented storage in the last 2 years during the pandemic had never used the product before, had never rented self-storage.
Oh, that's a great stat. That is a great stat.
And it might only be for 90 days, but really what it is they'll use storage on and off for the rest of their lives as they get put in situations where they need to store stuff.
True. So I want to hit a couple of points, right? You know, senior living, I know it did take a beating. I know I talked to somebody who had a few facilities and they had just a cleaning. They used to have a company come in and clean every so often, things like that. So it was just, you know, expenses, you know, skyrocketed. So if you were to compare self-storage to any other asset class, what comes close to it? What would you say? Because you said senior living is total opposite, right? So what's kind of close to it?
Yeah, definitely industrial. You know, low tenant improvements. The tenant is responsible, not a whole lot of changeover costs when some tenant leaves. The biggest difference, and I like to think about it, we're just renting a lot of smaller boxes. You know, it might be 1,000 boxes instead of 10 big boxes.
Sure.
The biggest difference between storage and industrial is the leases are 30 days. They're 30-day renewals. There's no really long-term leases in storage. And so what happens is, and all the leases, especially we use the REITs to operate. So Public Storage is our operator, Extra Space is our operator. And you wouldn't know the difference between a facility we own that Public Storage is operating and a facility Public Storage owns. But in the leases, they're written so that we can change rents. We can raise rents to track inflation every 30 days if we want. And about 65% of the people use credit cards to pay for their self-storage lease. And if you're anything like me, when I get the credit card statement and it says Apple this or Amazon that or Netflix this, I don't go in and dig around. I don't track it. I don't know if it went up or down. And in storage, if you're renting a place for $85 and you have a 10% rent increase, which is enormous, you know, percentage wise, then you get a bill the next month and it's $93 instead of $85. So it's a huge increase, but I didn't notice the $8 and I'm not going to go fight it. And so the only really ramification people have if their rents go up too much is they go move their stuff out. But a lot of people just don't want to deal with what's in self-storage. They don't want to take a Saturday to go clean out their self-storage unit. So it's just easier to rent it month after month.
Oh, for sure, right? You got to borrow your buddy's truck, or you got to go get a U-Haul. You got to spend, you know, half your day moving your stuff to maybe go four blocks down the road to pay, instead of paying $93, to pay $85. I'm like,
it never happens.
You know, $100 a year, I'm going to go through that. I'd just rather hang out and not go move. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that you're talking to me. I'm like, man, does he know what I do with his self-storage when I rent one? It seems like you're talking about me. You can double. Look, if I'm ever one of your clients, you can double my bill, just only me, and I still wouldn't move my stuff out. I'm like, hell no, I'm not going to go waste a Saturday. You know? Very interesting. So talk to me about your strategy, right? Well, you guys definitely have a unique way of kind of figuring out, you know, where are you guys going to start a new facility? Because you're doing ground up, right? Or do you buy also existing facilities or majority brand new build?
Yeah, our first fund, which was $53 million, and we're 100% of the equity in it, that was all ground up.
Okay.
And that started 2 years ago, and it really gets to capitalize on the increase in rents that we've seen in self-storage. Our second fund, which is a $35 million GP fund, that when we leverage that 90-10 with other LP equity, gives us about $350 million of equity to play with in our second fund. That will be ground up development and acquisitions. I believe at the point in the cycle we are right now, we're just finding better ground up development deals than acquisitions for a couple reasons. One, so much money poured into self-storage because once again, here's the third recession in a row, top performing asset, rents went way up. And so all these pension funds and large institutional players who didn't have an investment in self-storage, they all of a sudden had to buy something or build something. I'm sorry. So mostly they bought because that was the easiest way for them to get money out. So if you have so much money pouring in, then prices go up, cap rates go down, prices for existing storage went kind of crazy. Like it's really hard to find a good buy. So we've been more focused on ground up development, and storage has an Achilles heel. It can be overbuilt, and it does get overbuilt, and it will be overbuilt. Like markets like Denver, way overbuilt last cycle. Nashville, Tampa, got way overbuilt. And it's because everybody piled in, and next thing you know, if you've got too much storage, the only thing you can do to drive customers is just drop rates. And all of a sudden, pro formas got busted because nobody hit the rates they thought they were going to hit. So we still think it's a really good time to develop because a lot of deals are not getting done. And what I mean by that is construction costs go up, challenging. Interest rates go up, challenging. Supply chain, challenging. What is probably the biggest challenge that we see on a day-to-day basis is cities, municipalities, the ones that have to approve a zone change, a variance, a permit, they're extremely slow. You know, if we're having a hard time hiring people, imagine a city trying to hire a permit reviewer or a planning director. And so it's really taking probably 50% more time to get stuff through cities and approved. And I should say, not all cities are like this. Some are still good. A lot are not. And that means just less development is going to occur, which I think extends the development cycle a couple more years.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, that's what I heard. This, even the cities are you know, short-staffed and just taking a little bit longer. You know, even the building a multifamily now, it's like at 24 months, right? It used to be like 12, 14. Now it's at 19, 24 months. Everything's just taking a little bit longer. So
I mean, we have a project, Javier. It's on the East Coast. It'll take us 48 months from the moment we put it under contract, 48 months to get approval. It's a really, really long time. And we've got to have a lot of patient capital to get it through that approval. Thankfully, we never buy land until we have the approvals. So if a seller is not going to give us enough time to get the entitlements, the ability to build self-storage, we can't buy it. That's a hard and fast rule because we don't want to be stuck with land that we can't develop into self-storage.
Sure.
So that seller's got to give us 4 years, but that market will never get overbuilt because not that many people want to spend 4 years. And that's why the rates in that market are through the roof, because there's way too much demand and way too little supply. And so when we deliver that product, it's going to be gold. And I'm not worried about that getting oversupplied like a market like Houston, where there's no zoning, you can go anywhere you want.
Yeah, it's crazy. You can have a self-storage next to between two single family houses. It's insane.
It happens.
Yep.
It's crazy.
Yeah, for sure. So tell me a little bit about what do you guys look for when you're gonna either now that you're gonna buy or you're gonna build?
Yeah, I mean, our advantage is we've got a strategic partnership with Radius Plus, who is the, and anybody that's in storage, you know, go spend time on Radius Plus. They are the all comprehensive database for everything self-storage. They really revolutionized the data industry for self-storage. And so really what we have is a lot of access to data, everything from the supply existing, what new supply is coming online. You know, what are the demographics? How many people are renters? How many people own? Incomes, population, all the basics. But what also we dig into are things like how much new single family is being built in that market? How much new multifamily is being built in that market? Because those drive self-storage. You know, those homes, 12% of the U.S. population uses self-storage. So if we have 1,000 people, it's likely there's going to be 120 renters, 1,000 new people, 120 new renters. But I would say the most important metric for self-storage is just rates. It starts and stops with rates because think about storage like this. Once you've got that facility open, there are really two things you can do to drive business, to drive customers. You can spend more money on marketing, which has some impact, but it's more SEO, and SEO is expensive. You know, we don't send flyers out. It's really all internet marketing, maybe sure. some signage. So marketing has a very, not a huge impact. So what's the other thing that has the biggest impact is rates. If you're $20 cheaper than the guy across the street and you're roughly the same quality, somebody's going to come to you because people don't want to waste money on storage. So they're going to go where the price is cheap. So essentially, reducing rates is the way to tell if a market is, or to for you to drive customers, but you can follow the rate trends over time because the supply demand ratio, the pricing ratio for demand is really equal. Prices go up, demand goes up, the existing supply must go down. And so a lot of the big REIT operators, they're very, very sophisticated in their pricing algorithms, and they factor in all kinds of formulas, like what is their competitor doing? What happened this time last year? Was this weekend good? Like if it's a Labor Day weekend, how many units do we have left in this building of that size? And they raise and lower prices. And so prices in self-storage are very, very dynamic. And they tell a great story of how healthy or unhealthy that market is.
Yeah, for sure, right? What happened in this last Labor Day weekend, right? Well, we leased out a whole bunch of, you know, units. Well, maybe instead of doing $55 or $85 for 10 by 10, you go to 95 just for, you know, just for that weekend, right?
And maybe just for those 2 days, maybe you bump it up to 95 and then the next Monday it's back down to 65. It's the power of dynamic. So there are 55,000 storage facilities, 35,000 of those publish their rates online every day on the web. So it's a very transparent industry. Senior living, you never know what the prices are. Industrial, you don't know what the prices are, and they're not that dynamic. And so, and I would say the 20,000 that don't publish their rates, they're doing something wrong because everybody shops for storage on the internet. It would be like going to Kayak, searching for a flight from New York to Vegas, and five airlines had their prices, but then one airline said, call for price. Yeah. Are you going to call them to get price?
No.
Hell no.
Yeah.
So pricing, internet, you know, the sophistication of that really matters. I mean, and there are things you can do as an operator to be more successful, but there are two routes you can take and get one of the third-party managers, or you can manage it yourself. I would just say, and you can be successful either way. It's really hard to compete with the big third-party managers because they are very, very sophisticated.
Oh, very, very, very interesting. You're very interesting, you know, self-storage. I like everything about self-storage, right? But you did mention, right, the only, you know, downside is somebody can overbuild, right? So somebody can go across the street and, you know, build something there. I mean, you know, if it's available, right? So that's the only negative. So what would you say your least favorite asset class was? What would you say it was?
By far senior living, because it was an absolute operational business. It was less real estate, more operating business. And this is the analogy I use. In senior living, you could build the wrong product, you know, maybe the wrong unit mix. I don't mean drastically wrong, but not the best, in maybe an okay location. Maybe the timing wasn't even good. But if you have a good operator, you're going to be successful. Versus senior living, say you built the right location, the exact right product at the right time. And if you have a wrong operator, you're never going to be successful because it is an absolute operating business. And so, you know, that's not me. I'm a real estate person.
Senior living like hospitality on steroids. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Except you're dealing with people that are very emotional and it's a very long sale process and a lot of them are dying. I mean, I saw an incredible amount, like personally, it was very rewarding because you see people and daughters and sons of your residents who are really happy and really satisfied. You know, I don't get to see that in storage. Nobody cries in self-storage because you made their life better like they do in senior living. So I do miss that aspect of it, but I don't miss the fact that it's more of an operating business than it is real estate.
Definitely makes sense. Hey, real quick, I made a note here and I skipped over it. You're talking about your fund, right? So number one, how do people get a hold of you, right? Somebody wants to get a hold of you, like possibly maybe they want to invest in a fund or a project. They want to get a newsletter. Sure. What's the best way?
Yeah, best way is go to the website, dxd.capital, no .com, just dxd.capital. We've got a section where you can get in touch with us, and we've got a lot of high net worth family office investors. That's personally how I cut my teeth. And for 20 years, that's been kind of my bread and butter equity. So I really like the relationship. To us, it's about the relationship and understanding what the investor is looking for. Are they looking for cash flow? Do they want an opportunistic pop? Do they want to invest in something for 10 years? Or do they just want to be in for 2 years? And the more we know about what they're looking for, that's the cool part, is we can match up something in the self-storage world that targets exactly what they're looking for. But yeah, I mean, because of the structure of our second fund, we essentially just raised all the GP capital. And now we got to go and raise the 90% of the equity on a project by project basis. So we're going to be raising equity for the next 2 years. So tons of opportunity, and we love expanding our network.
That is awesome. Cool. DXD.capital, no.com. All right. So that'll be in the show notes. That'll definitely be in the show notes. So what would you say, this is the naked truth about real estate investing. So we talked about some good assets, some you didn't have as much fun with. You talk about self-storage as your favorite one. But what would you say was probably one of the, just a mistake? What kind of mistake did you make that you said, you know what, I'll never do this again? And how you can avoid it in the future?
Yeah, developers and real estate investors by our nature, we're all optimists. We see the upside. We automatically gravitate to what it can be and probably what it should be. But we probably don't test as much as what it could be on the downside. And what happens if rates are lower or it costs 10% more? So the mistake gets made my advice is to really test that project. Because if you're protecting your downside, the upside always takes care of itself. I mean, we look at those numbers, and instead of saying, what if it costs 10% more and the returns go down, we say, what if rents are 10% up? And we see that big number and we fall in love, you know, and we go. So really, really protecting the downside. But I would say one of the bigger mistakes that I made in my career is we had a project, you know, and we made it collectively. It's a team effort. We had a project where we had invested in the design. We hadn't bought the land yet, but the project had some questions, whether you move forward or not. And the first loss is always your smallest loss, is always your best loss. And versus a project that goes bad, it takes the same amount of time as 10 projects that go good. So even though, like, know when to cut, you know when to run, know when to say this isn't working, know when to sell. And because as optimists, we always think we can work through it. And the more harder I work, the better I'll make it. And I can figure this out. The reality is you might not be able to. There is nothing you can do that's going to make that project grossly better, maybe marginally better, but not grossly better. So know when to say, this isn't working, I shouldn't go forward. And you're going to be faced with losses. Like, that's the nature of this business. You don't always win. You just hope your wins well offset your losses, because the wins can be huge and the losses can be huge. And have a mentor or somebody you can talk to, or a gut check. Get an alternate perspective, because sometimes we get in our own brains.
Sure.
And just we start circling around without thinking what else could happen.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because we're optimistic, right? By nature, we just see, oh, this is going to be a great project, right? So yeah, be that devil's advocate, right? And figure out what, try to kill the deal. And if you do happen to get into a bad project, I would say it's better to have some short-term pain than long-term pain. Just pull that Band-Aid, suck it up, and move on. Because again, right, dealing with a bad project, it's opportunity cost. You know, you're sitting there dealing with this, taking money, taking your time. Now you're missed on another opportunity, some good project. I mean, you know, just you got to learn, right? Because you don't want to lose. So if you guys out there that are like me, that you hate losing more than you like winning, I say, I'm not going to lose. I'm going to learn. I'm learning here. Then I pulled the Band-Aid, right? So I don't feel like I'm losing. But anyway. Well,
you're right about that, because you can make a lot of mistakes in our world and still be successful. I mean, those are the projects you want that have so much margin that you don't have to do everything right to make money. You don't want the projects where everything has to go your way and then you make money. And so you're right. If you're going to lose or make a mistake, you really better learn from it. And that's the key to real estate investing. You'll never be faced with the exact same situation again. Every single investment situation is unique. And all you're doing is taking this collective years and projects, tens, hundreds of projects as experience and saying, here's what I learned, or here's what I should do differently, or here's what I should do better to make the best decision you can going forward.
Sure. That's awesome. Well, Drew, thank you so much for being on the show. And before I let you go, we're going to roll over to the best part of the show. And it's going to take a couple of minutes. I'm going to share my screen. Let me know when you see my screen.
All right. Killer. All right,
this is called the Naked Truth Roulette. So this has nothing to do with real estate investing. We're going to talk about your last three girlfriends. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's just a random three questions that we're going to ask you. I love having guests on the show who are super successful, just like yourself. And we answer a few questions and you know, we're still people, right? I mean, there's not much difference between all of us. We just hang around with our different people. We have different mindsets. We just take different action, but we're basically all the same, right? We're still all humans and we're still people, right? We still have life outside of real estate. So I'm going to ask three random questions and I wish you luck. All right. Question one for Drew. Oh man. Let's see if we get a hard one right off the bat. Most used curse word. How about that?
Oh, and it's got to be the F-bomb. It's got to be the F-bomb.
The F-bomb? Okay, cool. Yeah, I think that's the one I use.
It just highlights.
As well. It's got to be. My wife, she's never said a bad word in her life, and she's like an angel probably. I don't know. Question number two. All right, perfect. All right, there's a zombie apocalypse, okay? Now, you need to pick three people, famous people. Who would you pick to be on your team?
Oh, you know, I would choose Elon Musk.
Okay.
Super smart. I would choose Vladimir Zelensky. I mean, what that guy's done is just flat out amazing. If he can take on the Russians, he can take. And last, I'd probably take Chuck Norris because he's just badass.
You know, it's funny. I was watching something on Chuck Norris show that I was in a cruise and that is Chuck Norris reruns. And I just sat there watching these like, this is terrible, terrible acting, but I used to watch it as a kid. So,
oh yeah.
Got some good memories. Chuck Norris is definitely a good one. Awesome. Awesome. All right. Question number three. All right. Let's see what we got for the last question here. All right. What is the craziest thing you ever sneaked into a movie theater?
Ooh, this is not going to be too exciting, but I love going to a movie, especially if it's, now I'm not driving, but a kid's movie and I'm bored out of my mind. I bring a little flask with wine in it and I sit back and have wine or maybe a little vodka soda and it makes everything so much better.
That's hilarious. That is awesome. Yeah. A little bit of wine, maybe some people are bringing a beer, definitely vodka soda. That's definitely a good drink you can have. A little bit of lime on it. That's why I like it. Sit there. You know what? That's the only thing I've never snuck into a movie theater. I snuck in a whole bunch of other stuff. I even snuck in people and, but I've never done, you know, some, you know, vodka soda. I might
try. It makes boring movies a lot more exciting.
Awesome. Drew, you survived the Naked Truth Roulette. Congratulations. Thank you for being a good sport and answering these questions.
Killer. Thanks, Javier. Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add before we let you go to the listeners out there? Anything specific?
And you want to be good at real estate, you know, podcasts like this, Wall Street Journal, trade magazines, absorb as much as you can because you got to have a take. You got to have data. Believe it or not, there is something that you get every day. If you subscribe to these trade journals, or maybe it's your local newspaper or local business journal, that can help you make money. So find out what it is. Be open to learning and reading.
Awesome. Thank you, Drew, so much. It was really nice to have you on the show. And thank you so much.
Killer. Thank you, Javier. Great show.
I'm Javier, your host. Don't lose your shirt.
Just as promised, I like to give out free stuff, some tools and tips that's actually helped me in my business. There's nothing out there like getting some free stuff that people have spent a lot of time, energy in putting together. It's like a referral. Somebody asked me for an electrician. You don't know what kind of brain damage I had to go through to give you this good referral for an electrician. You got to appreciate referrals from people, okay? Because they went through a lot to find that one good person. So I'm going to give you my due diligence template for buying apartment buildings. It's attached to monday.com. It is an affiliate link, so they're going to send me a kickback. Not a lot, but a little bit. But you can either download it as an Excel, or you can put it on monday.com. Monday.com is pretty cool because it's a project management platform software. It's super cool. I use it all the time for my social media, for my team, tracking deals, doing tasks for everybody. It's actually pretty good. You can track construction. It's a project management platform. It's really cool. Monday, like the day, monday.com. So my due diligence checklist is there for free for you.
This has been The Naked Truth. Our mission is to give it to you raw. If you got value from this episode, you're invited to leave an honest written review and share this episode with a friend. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.